This just in, Santa Claus has announced he's going to develop a large-scale web application to handle all his present production system. He's decided on a package manager, and he's given each person a package to work on. There's been a lot of work there. Of course, as the system scaled out, they had to figure out how they would share the code. Santa came up with a unique color-coded system to manage the packages. And that's, my friends, how we ended up with Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Hey, your money back if you don't like these jokes. Daniel Markham here. It's Nerd Roundup. It's Friday. Hope you're having fun. Hope you had a good week. I am here by my lonesome today, so if you want to bail out now, it's fine, but there will be free candy later during the podcast, so you might want to hang around for that. I have a couple extra things to show you. James Green just pinged me and said he was on his way to his southern office, so he couldn't make it, but he and I have some things planned. I want to do a thing about TED, like Greg Young and I did last week about primitive obsession. Really wanted Bobster in that because Bob's pretty outspoken. And if Bob's not there, I'm just going to have to strawman him, and I hate doing that. But I think I'm going to do it anyway. So talk to James. I haven't heard from Greg. I hope that the world is good with Greg. Nerd Roundup is when we sit back each week and talk about kind of cool tech articles of the week. I put together a list of links. There are no rules. Anybody that's in like my top 10 friend list, not that I have them ranked, but I just picked 10 people that I thought may come by. And any one of those that drop by are welcome here. I would have 20 or 100, but I really am afraid that one day I'm going to have like 8 or 10, and it's going to be like the Brady Bunch on the screen. It's just going to scare the crap out of me. We're here to have fun. I think good teams demonstrate the kind of behavior that you want to see in the other teams, and we have a team of friends here, and if you can't have fun, kick back and talk about anything, then you're not going to be a very good programming team either. Okay, so this week's links. Okie dokie. Okay, first of all, what have I been up to this week? This week I have been coding a couple script files. That the Silence Detect program I was writing last week did not work as I expected because I was fakakta about how I thought it would work. The tiling program, I haven't worked on at all, and I'm a bad person for that. And then the Silence Detect program pointed out to me that I was actually over-processing audio for this podcast, so I adjusted those parameters as well. Okay, so first article. Oh yeah, by the way, one of the things I want to show you, and I've been showing this for the last few weeks, but we haven't really had time to talk about or introduce it. This is the Nerd Roundup morgue, and I keep all the archives here. And so about a month ago, I decided that as we talked about each article, I was just going to grab the whole article and stuff it somewhere in an S3 bucket. And that's not to violate anybody's copyrights. It's just to keep a record of the video and how it associates with the topics and how that associates with the current discussion. Because otherwise, the discussion would move on and people would ninja edit their stuff and it would just be a disconnected mess, which most of the web currently is. And I didn't want to do that. I didn't think it was fair to you guys. First article. Why we killed our end-to-end testing suite. Okay. So I looked at this. This is like many of these sort of, I'm a senior lead person, I'm telling you something really cool technically. It's like 70 to 80% on target, but then just kind of, it's like you're throwing a ball at basketball at a net. He threw it the right way, but he missed by about 3 feet. So what happened with this company is that they started down what they considered to be a microservice strategy route, which a lot of people are doing. Microservices is almost cooler than sliced bread or gas cooking. But then they coupled their microservices into their data store. They coupled the microservices into HTTP parent transport. They just coupled the crap out of everything, which companies want to do because they want to dive right into pre-existing architectures. But once you've coupled up all that crap, and then once you start writing what I consider not to be good microservices, well, guess what? You've got dozens or hundreds of little standalone little apps floating out in the ether that are all coupled into the rest of your system. You got a mess. And to fix that, the traditional thing we say as tech coaches is you do some mocking. And this company says, you know, golly, we did so much mocking that we can't do an end-to-end test. It's a disaster. Let's not do end-to-end tests anymore. Yay, boo. He did a survey. He talked to all the developers, you know, what happened to our current, why is it so sucky? Well, we have to wait. We don't have our confidence in the system. It's expensive. We can't figure out what the errors are. See, that's a good reason to get rid of your test system, because if you get an error that you have to work to go figure out, maybe you got an error you should be working to figure out. But then again, we could just go shopping. Slower value delivery, not efficient, not effective. The short version of this, which is what I keep harping on, is you got to build a test architecture. Your test architecture is freaking hella more important than your actual code. So all you people who are spending time coding, you're doing the wrong thing. Work on your test architecture. It should be fast. It should be efficient. I don't even care what you're testing. That's a different discussion. That's the coupling discussion. But you should have a fast test system. Your developers should be testing the things that are changing locally. And your end-to-end testing should be isolated. You have a skinny thread to pull through that system. You do not have a system that's all of, you don't have a big ball of spaghetti. Okay, so what happens when you couple things too much is you pull a little noodle out, suddenly you got a big ball of twine you have to sort out. This is why they can't figure out what the errors are. You couple microservices, coupling, pick one. Don't do both. Okay, jeez, guys. To follow up on that, and this is kind of the bonus thing I'm going to show you guys this week, I have added, for many of these articles, when we talk, I say, hey, you know, there's this other cool thing you should look at. So I've added a second link to these topics, and this second link is not a current article, but it's something if you want to dive down deeper on. This is a nice essay on creating a test strategy for asynchronous microservice applications. Not a lot of depth here, but I thought it was good to throw some more voices in. You know, it's not that you shouldn't have a data store. It's not that you shouldn't use HTTP. It's that premature optimization is going to fuck you all to hell, okay? So once you're forced, and absolutely at gunpoint forced, to use a relational database, use one. Once you're forced to use an HTTP transport, use one. No reason you can't use it. I'm not saying you shouldn't have it, but if your microservices are true microservices, they're pretty much even OS independent. So you add the message queue and all that crap on top of your microservices, not into them. Enough ranting for that. Here's a good essay by a guy who talked to, it's Designing Low Upkeep Software. And I thought the Hacker News discussion was actually more interesting than the essay itself. The first comment is, people think if a project on GitHub hasn't been updated since 3 months, then it has been abandoned. And the guy's absolutely right. For some, whatever reason, we as programmers, when we go to pick up some code off of GitHub, we look to see how long it's been since somebody's touched it. And if it's been a few days or a week, we feel more confident in using that code. The reverse is actually true. You can't write code to last forever. But, I mean, if you wrote code 5 years ago and it works fine, there are no new issues, you succeeded. You did the right thing. You might actually be a good programmer. I don't know. But I have to throw in my essay from 3 years ago. Good enough programming. I'm sorry, I'm not trying to plug myself, but I don't want to go through the whole thing again. Basically, whatever you code, you should be able to walk away from forever. And if you can't, and you have to come back to it for anything besides a new feature, you got problems. And I think everybody talks about clean code is talking about this, but what I'm saying is more than that. I'm saying that when they bump the rev up on your database or your Apache server or whatever, it shouldn't require you to have to recompile your code and retest it. Now, for some, it might, and I'm not saying that you shouldn't do continuous testing, but that's back to the coupling discussion. You should have good enough programming. This next website is super, super cool. This guy did a category theory illustrated site. He's got all kinds of little color graphics and animations, and so he talks about category theory. If you're not familiar with category theory, for those of you who know what generics are, like in C++ or C# or Java, category theory is sort of the generics of math, if you want a sort of a loose analogy. it is, what is the most primitive thing we can come up with that we can then create most all of math from? And you end up with little dots and arrows, and the arrows are actually more important than the dots, and there's this identity thing. So they start with the little simple things, and they end up building most of modern mathematics, which is freaking awesome. But if that isn't awesome enough, a lot of what they do in category theory is basically theorem proving, which is also programming. If you're programming in a purely functional way with no side effects, you're using category theory. The guys at Haskell that are doing the code, pretty much taking the category theory stuff and just turning it right into a text. So category theory is the thing you want to learn if you want to learn the meta thing of how to program. And I did not read this all the way through. I read about 6 pages. It looked really good. I do want to recommend this YouTube, this YouTube series, and the link will be on the website. There's a guy who about, 8 years ago, he is a programmer. I think he's a Java programmer. He did a series of about 10 lectures on YouTube on category theory, and it's kind of like me, you know, it's not the best thing in the world, but it was enough. It was really, really useful, and I enjoyed watching it. And for people who don't want to dive all the way into the books, try the videos, and if the videos don't work for you, here's the Illustrator website. It's good stuff. Next up, what is this called here? Yes, it's a little known fact that death is a way to lose at chess. It's in the rules. What are the ways you can lose? Where are we at here? Yes. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 ways to lose at chess. Abandon, adjudication, death. Losing player is called to greater things, one hopes. There's emergency, there's normal, there's rules infraction, time forfeit, and unterminated, which I guess means the game just kept going and we left, the judges left. So that got me thinking about what are all the kind of odd edge cases of chess, and I thought I knew them because I was, and I don't want to brag, but I was captain of my chess team in high school. We were a tough bunch. I thought I knew all the edge cases, but I found this 18 weird chess rules everyone forgets. And dang, if I didn't remember. I did not remember this. So there's a touch move. We all know you touch a piece, you have to move it. Pawn promotion can be for anything you want. Doesn't have to be just a queen. Most of us know that to play chess. Shane Gray couldn't be here. So then there's pawn promotion arbitration. So this has recently happened. One grandmaster was playing another one, and one guy advanced his pawn to be promoted and unable to find a queen anywhere. The other guy was holding his queen, which is kind of mean. So he took a rook and turned it upside down, which I have done many a time, to note it being so, just to indicate that it's a queen. But the arbiter immediately came over and stated that the upside down rook was still a rook, just an upside down rook. It was not a queen. You can't be playing loosey-goosey with pennies and stuff like that, because the rules are very specific about it. So he ended up losing the game, and he felt he was cheated, and I don't blame him. I would feel I was cheated, too. That really sucks. So if you got the other guy's queen, if you capture it, keep it in your hand, because he can't get it back, ever, which is weird. There's J-Dub, or I adjust, which is what you say if you're going to touch a piece to move it and you're not making a move. Most of us know that's a little more rare. There's insufficient losing chances. Since it's very complex, when you're in a spot where you think it's a book draw, in other words, the book says you can't ever win, and you got less than 5 minutes, both players can say, okay, look, it's going to be a draw because we know how to play to a draw, and the book says there's no other way that it's going to end, and you can just leave. You can have a incorrectly positioned board. You have to restart the game. It's not over. You have to restart it. But there's some interesting time rules. The player with the black pieces gets to decide which side of the chessboard the clock is located on. I had no idea that was true. Then there's a 50-move rule. I think most of us know that. So you just kind of, there's a 75-move rule. That's when you get to the end game and you get players, probably myself right now, who can't close the deal, and they just sort of chase one another around the board. And it's like, okay, just stop, kids, okay? There is a threefold repetition draw, and I did not know this one. So the rules say if you reach three different positions, if the same position has been repeated three times and no progress has been made, you can claim a draw, even if those moves weren't subsequent. So the 50 and 75 rules are more like you move stuff all around, and it's sort of a chasing scenario. This says that if you somehow get to the same position three different times, it's a draw, because you just can't get past that, however, for whatever reason. This explains castling as being a weird rule. I don't buy that. You can run out of time. The clock and the touch, you don't have to use one hand. You can't use both hands. You get penalized. You have to shake hands before a chess game in a tournament. I think I knew that when I was in the chess team, but I had forgotten it. There's en passant, which is what I think of when I think of edge rules. Most people don't know that, but it's kind of fun. Of course, there's stalemate. That's when the king is not in check, but he cannot move either, so you're just stuck. It's a draw. And those are the 18 kind of weird chess things, and I two or three of those I learned myself. That was kind of cool. Okay, so something less fun. I really hate to get back to this story, but, I mean, it's just, wow, it's an amazing story, too. Havana Syndrome attacks Wieden. The Havana Syndrome was discovered 5 years ago by diplomats, U.S. diplomats in Havana. They started having neurological symptoms, I think seizures, forgetfulness, and the people there, who their bosses, did not believe them, and they were harassed and told to get back to work and stop complaining. Well, eventually, somehow they got the attention of the right people, and they got an MRI done, and you know what? They got brain damage. And it's not just them. It started spreading in Havana. That's called the Havana Syndrome because that's where we first saw it. This article, it's amazing. They just pulled some people out of Serbia. They've tripled the medical staff at the CIA to try to figure out what the hell's going on. They replaced the guy in charge of the medical staff. In the last 60, 90 days, there have been a number of other reported cases, which you're not going to mention. But the doctor says they are seen as valid reports with verified health indicators. So what the hell is causing Havana Syndrome, these neurological symptoms that you can measure on MRI that may consist of permanent brain damage? Best guess I have is a directed energy weapon. And Bob and I talked about this about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months ago, and Bob kind of poo-pooed it. Oh, okay, this is like the, you know, you should be wearing your tinfoil hat now. And after that, it kind of bugged me, so I looked it up. And there had been quite a bunch of research done on directed energy, including microwaves, and how to really mess up people's heads with it. But they mentioned some other options, which could be subsonic stuff, could be hypersonic stuff. Ultrasonic. There's all sorts of things it can be, but the conclusion here, there's 5 years into this thing, and there's no smoking gun. This is a weapon. And once again, I'm nobody, so don't listen to me, but my money says that the Russians are using directed energy weapons or sound to physically attack U.S. diplomats overseas. And I say that because they started in Cuba and they're moving to places they have more and more control over the local police. I don't, where do you go from there? I mean, the Russians have been known to assassinate people on the streets of London. That's really messed up. I don't know how you deal with that. That's kind of world mafia level stuff. And we got to have diplomats. We have to have these people in foreign soil. So we're stuck having to have them. But if they're going to be targets, maybe you build a huge Faraday cages and just work inside of those. It's messed up. It's just messed up. And the article asks the question, which I ask, is what are our options? What can we do from here? I don't know. But I should point out, for those of you who still think it's not a real thing, that there was a similar type thing about 15 years ago that was total bullshit. And this was Morgellons. If you haven't heard of Morgellons disease, it was a thing that kind of swept the internet back in 2005. And all sorts of folks talked about it. They had pictures, and they talked about how they were suffering. And there's a foundation for it. But it's been 15 years, and the people who were suffering claimed they were growing fibers out of their skin, which is bizarre. But when they started looking at the fibers, it was just cotton. So it was just cotton. They were just wiping themselves in the whatever they, towel sticking to their skin. So Morgellons, so far, is just like a bunch of smoke. I would say pseudoscience, but that's probably giving it too much credence. But the wiki page has a bunch of cool stories about how it got started, what the current status is. But I do not think that this is, Havana Syndrome is not another Morgellons. Havana Syndrome is an attack. And it occurs to me that we're currently at war, right, a cyber war with many nation and non-state actors. We're currently now, it looks like, in a directed energy shooting war with somebody. I would assume they would be a nation, a state. For a world at peace, we got a lot of people hurting one another, sub rosa, and maybe that's the answer. Maybe the answer is if we think that the Russians are the ones doing this with Havana Syndrome, maybe turnabout's fair play. Maybe if you get punched in the nose hard enough, you stop punching. Okay, that's kind of a bummer, dude. Next story, a monk in 14th century Italy wrote about the Americas. So those who don't remember their song in 1392, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Or 1492. Anyway, this is 100 years earlier than that. They had a monk in the Mediterranean who was writing about America. At that point, they called it Mark Landa. And here's a paper with the abstract. I've got most of the abstract here. And what they're thinking is that the Vikings discovered North America. It came by word of mouth all the way down to the Mediterranean. It was written about maybe a couple, three times. And that rumor was kind of what kicked off the idea that there's a way to go from here to there. And people have done it. In either case, this guy is the first person we know of writing down about the story of North America, which is cool. So that's history in the making, which I love watching those stories because there's a lot of argument back and forth. And there's another story just like that. It came out a couple months ago, I think. It was last week. Fossil footprints prove that humans populated the Americas thousands of years earlier than we thought. So there's been this discussion over who got here first. I think it's sort of the playground. If you're on the swings first, the other people can't have the swings. We've been trying to figure out how humans have migrated for a long, long time. DNA's helped a lot. But I know the story's changed three or four times just in my lifetime. Generally, there's an outer Africa story that the humans came out of Africa. As of 10 years ago, the last time I took a course, the outer Africa theory says that Africa bloomed because there's a lot of rain in North Africa. And then it became a desert, and then it bloomed and became a desert several times. It's currently a desert. And that cycling actually pushed people out. People would come to North Africa, they would thrive, various, I guess, forms of humans, and then they would go on off to the Mideast and Europe. So they think there's several waves of folks coming out of Africa. At some point, these people went all the way across Eurasia, came across the land bridge over the Bering Straits now, but at that point it was dry land, and started populating the Americas. We used to think it was about 25,000 years ago. It was after the last ice age because, hey, dude, if it's an ice age, the whole continent's covered with ice. Where you're going to, there's nothing to eat. But this is showing different. And it wouldn't surprise me if we end up putting these people before the last ice age, which may have had them coming across, I guess the ice age before that could be maybe 100,000 years back. It's also not clear that these are actually the people who are currently called Native Americans. they may be just like the Denovids. They just be sort of a subspecies of human. Because once you start going back, you know, 80, 100K years, there were other human species here at that time. So we can tell there was some tool-making stuff. We found things to investigate. But as far as what the species was, that's a whole different question. So very, very cool story developing here. And this is also something that's been going on for the last 20 or 30 years. People have said, no, this goes way back. They were here 50, 80,000 years ago. And everybody said, nah, you're just bullshitting. And now it's starting to look like, yeah, maybe so. So they got to the playground first. This is my uber nerdy non-programming article. And the title is Place, Personhood, and the Hippocampus. The Fascinating Science of Magnetism, Autonoetic Consciousness, and What Makes Us Who We Are. And so I just we got hippocampus, we got magnetism, because who doesn't like magnetism? We got autonoetic consciousness, whatever the hell that is. I want to read about it because I can tell it to other people and they won't know what the hell it is either. And what makes us who we are, which is like how our brain works. So it is all good stuff. And I started reading this thinking, okay, well, this is just going to kind of be a kind of pop science bullshit article. No, not at all. This is actually a review of a book, I think called Wayward. And, hang on, I put on the reading mode, so it actually took away the, Wayfinding. So as I understand this, and I have the wiki article coming up next, the autonoetic consciousness is the thing that makes us uniquely human, one of the many things. It is our ability to map a story of ourselves and our environment over a period of time and predict where we might be in the future. So it is it's a metaconsciousness level. We're looking at our own brains and our own selves from the outside, and we're saying, hey, I'm a guy who came from the hood, and I was beat up as a kid, and we're telling the story of ourselves inside a particular geography, and then we're able to do counterfactuals. Well, what would happen if I had a good education? What would have happened if the sun didn't shine? We're able to do future prediction. So it's this ability to model the story around our lives from a meta level. It's our brain's ability to model our brain. That is autonoetic consciousness. And here's the Wikipedia article. The autonoetic consciousness is the human ability to mentally place oneself in the past and future, mental time travel, or in counterfactual situations, and thus to be able to examine one's own thoughts. So this is just a hell of fun. So I am looking forward to the day when I'm in a discussion about artificial intelligence. Say, you know, guys, I know it can show me which restaurant to go to, but I'm not sure we're really hitting all we should be hitting on autonoetic consciousness. And then just seeing who... Hey, John!
John. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, hang on a second. Let me capture the screen here.
Trying to squeeze in some nerd roundup.
Have you ever heard of the phrase autonoetic consciousness?
No.
Yeah, I hadn't either.
That's a quick no.
Yeah, that's why I had that captured. It is the brain's ability to tell the story of the brain. So, you know, you tell your story about how I grew up in a poor family and this and that happened. It's your ability to model your own self. It was a fun article that was, I gotta admit, I love the phrase. I'm like, cool.
Yeah, autonoetic.
Autonoetic, yeah. Yeah, I got here, but there was a book called Wayfinding, and this author, who's I guess a doctorate, talks about how the physical surroundings you grow up in become part of your life story, and if you grew up climbing mountains, maybe you have a tougher mentality than if you grew up in a desert or whatever. It was an interesting kind of nerdy thing that I had never heard of before.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, because it certainly can shape a lot, just like the environments in which you work.
Yes.
Can shape a lot.
And that,
were they controlling? Were they, yeah.
And well, then on that, but the code, the IDE you use, the architecture you're using, all that, every part of your environment is shaping your mental story about how good a coder you can be.
Yeah.
Did you hear about the pulling diplomats out of Serbia for the Havana Syndrome?
No.
So do you know what the Havana Syndrome is?
Cigars?
Too many cigars. You got to go home, bub.
And just a love for 1955 Chevys.
Ricky Ricardo, Lucy, I am home. So this has been a story for 5 years that nobody hardly talks about. Best we can figure, diplomats and embassies are under directed energy weapon attack. And it's gone from like freaky pseudoscience, who believes that, to like they've tripled the medical staff at the CIA. They're pulling diplomats from other locations, not just Havana anymore. There's MRI. These are physical things they can observe.
Yeah, that sounds vaguely familiar about the incidences of this. Yeah, I guess if you get enough random data points, they're no longer random.
Right. Right. When it's just, see, what happened was it happened in Havana. That's why I call it Havana Syndrome. And the boss guy said, no, you guys are just goofing off. You're trying to malinger. But then they started doing MRIs, and the conclusion of the Post article was, okay, well, it looks like we're under attack. It looks like we're not going to be able to figure out who's doing it.
You sure it's not like the formaldehyde in the foam insulation and or the rugs or the, you know, like funny stuff like that, which is not an uncommon, you know, odd problem as well.
Yeah, it would be weird that it would happen in multiple embassies and only to certain people in the embassies.
Yeah.
So next is an article, Why Science Can't Settle Political Disputes. And it's a long one. Basically, if you mix science and politics together, both suffer tremendously. So stop doing that.
Yeah, we're proving that. For the past, you know, 18 months, since March 2020, we're proving that, I would submit.
I told Bob, two, 3 years back, we were talking on Facebook. I'm like, look, scientists should not be advocates. He's like, no, I think if you think something's true, you should advocate. I'm like, no, you can't. The thing is that
that's the opposite.
Yeah, once you start thinking of the messaging involved with being an advocate, you're no longer doing science. You're being a public figure at that point. And yeah, that's a bummer. So this guy goes through about 2,000 words to say the same thing. But he does it in a much better way. It's funny because first he digs out Ted Cruz and he beats him around the head and shoulders, and he digs out somebody on the left and beats him up some. And then finally we get to the end where I guess he's like done all his sort of cavorting and what genuflecting to both sides, and he can actually say, hey, don't do that.
Yeah, it's a good advice.
For folks who are interested in this topic, I included Taylorism in here because I think Taylorism is where we first got started with the idea of we will just take apart anything that's complicated and we will do science on it. And science will make it better.
And like it's a machine.
Like everything's a machine, yeah.
Yeah, same thing with you know, when organizations do that, they try to break down what they do into, I don't know, I always blame that for like merit MBO or whatever that was. It's probably wrong because I was never really involved
with KPI, it. KPI, MBO, there's the scorecard stuff. What is that?
Yeah, the breaking down what we do into discrete chunks and thinking that if we only dealt with the discrete chunks, why we figured the system out. I mean, it might work for complicated systems, but not complex systems. I think that's the problem.
You know, as programmers, maybe we have sort of a unique insight on this because, you know, I can give you an int. I can give you a function that returns an int. I can create a 4 million line big hunk of code that returns an int. You know, just because we have a concept that's int doesn't mean we can just keep breaking it apart all we want. There's nothing there. You keep going, right? Forever. Yeah, I say intellectual work is infinitely divisible. So this is super, super cool. Sort of the 10,000 foot view. You know how we have certificates for identification, like SSL certs?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This idea is to do the same thing for in a temporary way for people. So you can register, pick up your identification, and take it with you, various websites, spend money, and then throw it aside and get a new cert later on. It's a cool idea. It would actually make the web decentralized and anonymous, and as you can imagine, Google, Facebook, and the usual bunch don't like it.
Yeah, so I mean, probably a really good idea.
It is a really good idea. It's probably never going to happen.
It's like a flat tax.
Yeah, or fair tax. It's it makes so much sense that there's just no freaking way it's ever going to happen. So here are the goals for it: decentralization, control, privacy, security, proof-based, discoverability, interoperability, portability, simplicity, and extensibility. So, you know, these guys have, this is W3C, they've dived into it. This isn't just, you know, a lark. Kind of see where it goes, I guess.
Yeah. How it starts.
So, have you ever heard the phrase, Democracy in America, the book by de Tocqueville, I think?
Alexis de Tocqueville.
Yes.
He came over and, you know, was kind of maybe a little bit like the Agile Manifesto gathering. Like, hey, there's a bunch of these folks that are having success using lightweight methods. I wonder what's up. You know, what's the gist? And I think I was, hey, let me go wander through this new country and go, I wonder what's making them so successful. Yeah, it's a fascinating.
And he wrote a book. I was here for 9 months. I think the French sent him to figure out how we could be doing so much with so little.
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense to them. And, you know, he reported back a bunch of cool stuff. I recommend the book. But one of the things he said was that the more people participate in sort of civic organizations, the more productive society is overall without it having to be a hierarchical organization. If you go to court and be a juror next to the guy who's across the street, you may disagree on politics and religion and everything else, but you're being jurors right now. It teaches you not to be such an asshole.
Right.
And it turns out that we're rediscovering what we already knew 200 years ago.
Yeah, that's a little bit like the difference that how schools started back in the day versus how the now current public education behemoth was created.
Yes.
You know, for basically trying to get agricultural people smart enough to be able to be good factory workers, right, in the Industrial Revolution.
I was told it was World War One, maybe.
Right, it was around there, but yeah, I mean, it was basically to get people just maybe to the eighth grade level so that they could be functional adults in serving, you know, the industrial complex, so to speak. And, you know, a little bit of, you know, a recent politician says something like, yeah, no, parents shouldn't be involved with caring what the kids are being taught or things like, right? I mean, no, like to Tocqueville's point,
yes.
Being that more, you know, it's the old, if you can go down to the street and knock on a door and have a conversation with the teacher or the, you know, or the you know, neighbor, the juror, right? That those just get pushed by the side.
Your representative used to be one House representative for every 10,000 people, I think.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I just responded to a tweet about, yeah, you know, can please just level-headed people come to school board meetings, because you know we don't want to talk about any names, a couple of subjects. You know, I'm tired of that. I'm like, sorry, this is messy. Number one, you're dealing with people's kids and taxes, so can you pick any two bigger issues to like for people to be concerned about? No, don't say you don't want to talk about. You know, don't have people again. That's we don't want people, and we don't want those pesky parents involved. Yeah.
Yeah, you kind of us versus them, sadly.
Sadly, yeah.
If for some reason we naturally feel that important things should be big, and important things should have lots of detail and lots of hierarchy, because it's important, we should spend a lot of money on it because it's important.
Yeah. And there's a false sense of, well, we know the right answer. And another thing we often say, well, you know, I'll joke. Yeah, I'd put me in charge, because if we're going to just jump right to the conclusion, let it be mine. Versus, it's kind of messy for the collective society and, you know, village to arrive at. You know, it might be painful and it might not be as efficient because I knew the answer. It's not unlike working with development teams where, yeah, I could tell you the answer. And I'm probably right, because like the other 10 times, they worked out. Probably this 11th time. But I'd much rather help you arrive there as a team and understand the philosophies and the reasons, not just do what I tell you. Right? And that's how I think governance should be.
I agree. I've been modeling organizational learning for a while. I had a phrase in, I think, the first book called Profound Ignorance. And when I studied startups, one of the things I learned about successful startups was their ability not to jump to conclusions about things other people would naturally. They're more like, okay, well, let's just see if that's really true. Let's test this. Let's try that. Let's test this. And they did not associate their ego with some sort of preordained solution.
Right. That's a big key.
Powerful stuff.
And it's powerful to apply that at the feature level, getting, you know, back to software.
Yes.
The epic or the whole product.
Yeah. Right? I mean, I'm a good. Oh wow. Yeah. You. It's just the pain. The pain becomes even worse. We're gonna drag it back to software because people will buy into. I was just talking about this guy who did a microservices essay, and long story short, they bought into a microservices platform with all this bolt-on crap that everybody says you're supposed to have, and then they got coupled into their architecture, and then now their end-to-end tests are crap. It's like, yeah, because you've coupled all the hell into things before you needed to. Yeah, I imagine it would be crap.
Yeah, and that's a little bit like how I try to describe, you know, the art, so to speak, apparently, since I'm not very good at helping people necessarily do it, but of going from the fuzzy to the discrete. As you're building a product and you're having epics and ideas and roadmappy things, but by the time they hit dev, they better be crisp and small and tight. But how do you get there? Do you do that all up front, right? I mean, what's the risk that why do I need to do it all up front? So it's the perspective of risk is really hard sometimes for people to grasp that, you know, and often, and that's in the face of, despite me doing it all up front, and it's still not right. It's still, I'll know it when I see it. Well, why do people still insist on, you know, the large depth way up front before it's necessary? And that's another very, very hard topic that, well, I think is.
When I got into the first book, I was trying to figure out why we couldn't write good enough specs. Because I'd always heard that, but why not? And I did a bunch of research, and there's a guy named Wittgenstein and a guy named Peirce and lots of stuff. But at the end of the day, human language was not meant to write computer programs with. It's just meant to throw out a couple syllables and maybe some hand gestures and convey, let's go hunting, let's, you know, kill that lion or whatever. But the entire goal of human language is minimal amount of symbolism. You just assume the rest and we go forward. And so we're constantly redefining the symbolism, constantly redefining what people have to assume. It's like almost like a dance, a performance. Whereas software, software Boolean, true or false, unless you got one of those true value Booleans, and then, God bless you. but you're right. So best I came up with was that testing first, whether it's testing or whatever, does at least a double check that says, okay, if we use these words in this fashion, will that test what we wanted over here? That tends to narrow it down quite a bit.
Yeah, and for me, it's trying to help people at least acknowledge what we do up front instead of doing the thing we're doing is some form of risk mitigation. Whether, and I like to say, you know, I want to do just enough, maybe slightly less up front.
Yes.
That's a hard, if someone who wants a recipe and wants to follow, you know, well, what do you mean? Tell me how to do that. Well, it's different for every scenario. You know, the point is to observe. And, you know, like, wow, we did all this UI stuff and mock-ups, and it still wasn't right until they actually used it. Okay, cool. Well, maybe starting coding right away and without any mock-ups isn't right either. But there's that, just have some humility to look back and say, well, maybe we should have done less and get into the doing faster.
I'm a big domain modeler. I have been ever since I learned database modeling. I love domain modeling.
Yep, it's critical.
But one of the things I will do, and I actually tend to love doing this, is we will model on the whiteboard. I will erase the whiteboard. And then we'll come in the next day and model again. And once anybody in the group can model and everybody understands what's going on, we have agreement on what we're doing. And then we can move forward from there and talk about modules and blah, blah, blah. But until we all agree on the multiplicity issues, singletons, all that stuff, we don't have agreement. That gives us a good sort of stopping point between language and code.
Yeah. To me, it's one of the key aspects of doing product development is understanding the domain, for sure.
Yes.
Because that's the language by which we'll have all the discussions and all the specs and all of the, you know, naming of components, you know, anything. And it's the lingua franca, however you might say it. It's the language we would use.
Well,
what
we'll also do is, of course, there's two parts. There's the structure that we're using, the domain model, when we're having a conversation. There's the behavior that domain model has to support.
Correct. And that's how the domain model arose.
That's how it arose. Without a behavior, support a behavior, you got no model. But right. So what you should do is say, okay, we're going to like validate a customer, and you point to the thing, and you walk through how that happens, and then we all agree on the important concepts. It's almost like a pre-code. You know, test in language first, and we'll put it in code, and it'll be different by the time we code. It'll be a lot different, really.
Mm-hmm. And that's part of the just enough, right? You do enough of that. Like, I don't need to know the details of the user, like, I got to have middle name and I got to have these other 17 attributes. Who cares? There's no risk in that. It's more of the big picture and getting the pieces to support the requirements, the behavior we're looking for, the end, you know, the outcomes we're expecting.
So you
get these pieces. And I would also say, I think there's a domain, and then orthogonally, it's the architecture. Like, how does that, you know, what does that part look like? Because I'm just going to do the domain on top of the, you know, like Rails is an architecture, right? Or JEE, or, you know, anything like that. You're sort of poking at the architecture at that point on which to overlay the domain and get your results.
Well, and then there's the issue of how much time you're going to spend whatever architecture you have. So you're going to have to deploy to some sort of architecture, some platform. The code doesn't exist in thin air. But how much overhead are you going to have with that substrate? I just wanted to say, what really taught me this, what you were saying about incrementally adding to your domain objects, was I learned how to do relational data modeling, used Erwin, had a bunch of fun, made a bunch of really cool,
I remember that.
Yeah, level 5 databases. It was a blast. I understood it. It made sense. Set theory was my friend. And then I think Microsoft came out with something they called this spiral rapid application delivery, maybe.
Sounds familiar.
And I was reading a book, I think Jeff, maybe it was in McConnell's book, and he was talking about, you don't have to do it all. And I read it, I'm like, what and how in the hell could that even be possible? And then I thought, well, you know, I could just really name the concepts and we could talk about them, and then I could add things as I needed them.
Correct.
And that just changed my entire view of how to do modeling at that point.
Yeah, and then the other adage that I would help developers, you know, embrace is, so you get a new feature request. Does it fit in the existing model? Like, maybe I just add attributes to some existing, or is it some new concept that I've got to, in other words, instead of like jamming it into your model with a bigger hammer, no, the model can't support it. So add something to the model that's a new piece. And then that'll make it easy to add. You know, it's a classic. If it's hard to add something that on the surface, when the user, you know, or the business asked for it, that's a simple request. Ooh, it's really hard to add. Ding, 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 ding. That means you're probably missing some element in your domain.
That's what I was saying about that guy who wrote the essay that our end-to-end test is too slow, let's go shopping. It's like, dudes, if it's too slow and you get all these sort of symptoms of we don't like it, there's something wrong. You need to go. Don't ditch the whole thing. Go fix the thing that's wrong.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So there's a backup essay. I think this is called, what is this? The Tocqueville crisis, the Tocqueville problem. So plenty of reading there. New unbreakable glass inspired by seashells. So they make glass that's so unbreakable you could like bend it around.
Wow.
Yeah, that sounds really cool. It looks, he says it's like plastic. It's as strong as, stronger than glass. You can bend it like plastic.
That's actually, yeah, I love taking inspiration from things that have been evolved over millennia, because it's pretty damn awesome. You know, like, I was just chattering with Mr. Turley, who you know, John Turley, about we're just kind of, when things are in awe, like, are mind-boggling, and you know, my wife says, hey, what, you know, doing a crossword puzzle, what's the unit for capacitance? And I just blurted out ohm.
No, that's resistance.
Yeah. And then, you know, so I mean, that blurted out before I even thought of anything. And I said, no, it's ferret.
Yeah.
You know, like, immediately on me correcting myself. And then I just sat back and go, damn, the brain. When's the last time I had to know that? Right? Like, how does it, like, I couldn't have even Googled it that fast. How the hell does this thing work?
Then you can't find your keys. You can't find the thing you just had in your hand. Like, where the fuck is this thing?
Right. Oh, they're in my pocket. Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, high school teacher was Mrs. Atkins.
Well, yeah, things in nature are continuously humbling, basically.
I guess early on, maybe I was 12 or 13, I wanted a communicator like I saw in Star Trek. And so I went to the library. I may have been 10. And I got their best electronics book they had, because I was going to build me a communicator. Of course, he was like, it's third, fourth year college electronics. And I opened it up, it's got the calculus, and I'm like, oh, wow. This is going to be tough. I don't remember any of that book, but I remember getting it and, like, struggling for, like, a week with it.
That's funny.
But, yeah, and then some of that struggle you remember later on, I remember I was talking to James about electron shells and chemistry of all things.
Right.
I was like, why do I remember this?
Yeah.
If you're interested in transparent aluminum, or if you're in Britain, aluminium.
Well, it's very transparent if you're as small as an electron. There's a lot of space.
Yeah, sure. Gamma rays about, and everything is going to be transparent.
Yeah.
So they have made transparent aluminum. This was a joke in Star Trek 4, and then they actually came out and made it.
Oh, wow.
So it's weird. So this is one we should have a lot of fun with. This is yet another expert who, how Big Tech runs tech projects in the curious absence of Scrum. So this is probably the biggest honking essay I got this week, and it goes on. On blah blah blah. He actually spoke with real people, and he did a real survey with numbers and everything. He's got a chart. Big Tech, basically, if you ask the right people, they'll tell you teams can pick their own processes, which is fine. Me, I mean, I don't think that precludes or says you have to do Scrum. And he also thinks of Scrum as being one of the heavyweight processes, which I'm like.
It could be.
I can see why it's normally implemented as a micromanagement tool that really sucks, but you could do Scrum a sprint every day if you wanted to.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. Recent teams that I've been leading and working with, you know, I've had, the owner of the company say, hey, I talked to my brother-in-law. He's out on the West Coast, and he's working with the team, and they're doing these monthly sprints. Can we do monthly sprints? Sure, if you want it. Yeah, whatever. Don't care. Right. Literally, it didn't change an iota of how we work and how we deliver value in the flow. Because it's like, I could care less. That has nothing to do with, if you understand what it means to deliver software and deliver value. Those are just random temporal containers that you can either let it screw up your delivery or not. So for me, it was totally random, because we basically still just did mostly Kanban types, right? I mean, like it was just in some weird time sink.
So the first thing you have to do in a team is vote some poor schmuck to be the manager. because he's going to have to suffer through all the meetings. And then his job is to keep everybody.
I usually take that spear. Yeah, like I'll take one for the team. That's usually me. Yeah.
And yeah, and that guy has no rank. As a matter of fact, he's probably the lowest guy on the team. It's like we're going to miss you too much, okay? I did an exercise bringing the books up. I'm not trying to plug them, but I did this thing about how could you do a project management system with a minimal design? And the answer was Notepad. What I did, is it done or not? Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you name the file after yourself, mark them. You know, did this done? Did this not done?
Right.
That's it.
Yeah, it's like a to-do list, right?
Yeah. To-do list.
Pretty much, that's the fastest way to do six things. I don't know, one at a time.
Yeah, that's even faster than Trello. I mean, you don't even need the post-its for that.
No, and that's, yeah. By the way, I got a bolt in 4 minutes to do a training session.
No problem.
but yeah, that's kind of my long-standing joke, as software really is. It's a to-do list. And how you choose to do that, you know, obviously that's the to-do list of how we're going to show features that people want, you know, value. And the order in which we're going to do things, but
when we did the program management, I used to tell people, look, just add in, keep the list under like 7 items for each person, and instead of saying an undone, just say, hey, I think I got more 7 hours on it, and you can change anytime. I don't care. Just guess how many hours you got on. Well, guess what? Now I've got all that crap you ever wanted to print out in your reporting tool, just using Notepad and a couple scripts.
Yep, doesn't require a lot.
So yeah, Scrum being a heavyweight process, yep, I'm with you. But it doesn't have to be. I think we fall under a lot of times what they call the McNamara fallacy. McNamara was the defense secretary during the Vietnam War. He used to work for General Motors, big dimming guy.
Mm-hmm.
And so he thought we should be counting up everything. And if we did the appropriate accounting of the war, that we would win the war through accounting. And they, of course, did not turn out so well.
Yeah. I do remember that, yeah.
Yeah, they used to do the body count thing, and then so everybody, you know, you'd shoot one time and have 10 bodies. Because if you give people stats, they're going to give you, manage to the stats every time.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll take that challenge. I'll outgame anybody.
All right, so I'm just going to keep running through this. You just hang up when you've got a couple more minutes here. This is offline first. And you do web apps. This guy basically says something I've been saying for years, which is, if you don't have to couple your front end to your back end, don't, because it forces you into a better architecture. It makes your app more resilient when the web connection drops. It's just a good idea all around.
Yeah, a funny thing that I try to drive is always saving. There shouldn't be a save button. It's the same. Similar concept. Like, why do I have to click save? Can you please just save everything I do? I mean, it's not easy in every situation, but that I have built some apps with that as the concept. And they were apps to fill out, you know, mortgage insurance applications, you know, things like that. Just save everything.
Well, you know, the browsers have what's called local storage. You know, I think you've got up to, like, I don't know, 50 megs, 100 megs. You've got a lot in local storage. You can run a database instance there. And one guy on Hacker News said, hey, look, just throw your save into the database as if it were an event, and then pull the database back to the server, and then you have instantaneous access to what's going on. You've got a live back and forth system. It was good for everybody.
Yep. All right, Daniel, sir, I got a bolt a little early, glad I could drop in and have some fun chatting.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate it.
All right. I'll catch up.
All right.
See ya.
Bye. That was cool. Got a couple more here. These tunes do not exist. This is the using AI to generate cartoons, which, you know, we've seen using the generative adversarial networks to do people. Now we can do cartoons. And I don't know if you can see this, but, I mean, they're kind of cool-looking little cartoons, but their eyes are not right. I don't know. They're just not collimated. They're looking different ways. Maybe that should be fixed. Bad news. And the last story And by the way, this website, you go and you just keep clicking the button and you keep seeing more and more random little cartoon people. I just want to point out that Greg Young and I last week did an article on primitive obsession. Basically, I saw somebody tweet about primitive obsession. It annoyed me, and I messaged Greg. I'm like, Greg, you got an hour? Let's do a quick video. And we did. And it got a lot of traction. I mean, it was, I think I got about 10,000 views to the blog on this one. So if you're interested, the primitive obsession is right there on danielbmarkham.com. Okie dokie. So I think I can do the goodbye thing now. Here we go. You have wasted yet another hour on Nerd Roundup, and I hope you like the jokes. If you do not like the jokes, please feel free to send in your own jokes to I Have New Jokes, New York, New York, 24107. We're going to be here next week. We're having a lot of fun. I will see you on the internet.